This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. For some, voting is seen as the bedrock of our democracy. People fought and died for the right to vote, and some are still fighting to protect that right to this day. You even get a sticker for showing up to the polls. So why then do nearly 100 million eligible Americans not vote? Well, we asked you, and here's what you told us.
I'm George from Seattle, and I'll tell you why I don't vote in elections the way I used to. I still vote for initiatives and things where I have direct comment and direct impact on the result. But the district I live in and most states are so gerrymandered that it doesn't really ultimately seem to matter who's in charge.
My name is Thomas. I am early 50s. I've never voted a day in my life, and it is due to religious reasons.
This is Lee Wilson out of Trustville, Alabama. I myself am a millennial, and I find the area that I live in is so gerrymandered, it feels frivolous to go cast a vote. Besides that, just the process of trying to find time to get off of work, since voting's not a holiday.
Hi, this is Bill from Philadelphia, and I'm actually calling in response to asking the question why we don't vote. I don't vote. And the reason I don't vote is because nothing ever changes. You know what? It just makes it worthless. It really does make it worthless. It really doesn't matter.
A study published by the Knight Foundation earlier this year was one of the biggest to look into the habits of non-voters. What they found was that this group is just as diverse and complicated as the rest of the country. Here to talk about why so many people are choosing not to vote and what it means for not just 2020, but for our democracy is Colin Woodard, contributing editor for Politico magazine and author of Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Colin, welcome to 1A.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Bernard Fraga, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University and author of The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. Professor Fraga, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Colin, we just heard from some folks there about why they're choosing not to vote. But why? What are some of the other reasons people don't vote?
Well, they expressed some of them. I mean, broadly speaking, there are a lot of reasons that non-voters don't vote, and they sort into clusters. But you hear time and time again a combination of either a lack of enthusiasm or belief in the candidates and that the candidates will affect change for them, or that the system itself, broadly speaking, no longer is able to deliver the sort of changes and policies that they might want, or that the system itself is corrupted, or that they don't understand it. Either their lives are too busy or they're disinterested from it to feel that they can put in the time to make the educated choices to decide which candidate they might vote for or what policies they might be voting for. Something that many people find is getting more complicated as the media environment is fractured and become more polarized for people who don't, you know, in quotes, follow this stuff all the time. I think it's getting harder and harder to know how to sort, you know, fact from fiction and to be able to sort of figure out just what is going on if you're not following this stuff regularly. And so a combination of reasons.
And when we talk about a non-voter, how are we defining that?
Well, the Knight Foundation study, which is the most comprehensive look yet of non-voters, defined it as a person, you know, who's at least 25, who'd only voted in one of the election cycles since 2008, essentially wanting to make sure that you've been an eligible voter long enough to confirm your track record as being a non-voter and that you very seldom vote.
Professor Fraga, you've looked at voter turnout by demographics. Which groups turn out to vote the most and which turn out the least?
Sure. So the patterns we've seen historically and the trends we're likely to see in 2020 indicate that older Americans, more wealthy Americans, more politically interested and involved Americans are far more likely to vote than younger people, than racial and ethnic minority groups, and then people who are just disengaged from the political process.
Why are young people so much less likely to vote?
Well, there's a number of reasons, and we heard some of them earlier from the callers, right? One part might be because it's difficult to register to vote for the first time. Some states are very stringent about their requirements for documents you need to produce in order to register. In addition, young people are a very mobile population. They're moving around a lot, changing residency, and each time you need to re-register to vote, every state has different rules, different requirements, and those are difficult to navigate, especially for a young person who hasn't voted a lot.
And I'm wondering, Colin, whether that might have an even deeper impact this year with the pandemic and people maybe not having access to the normal means by which they'd register to vote.
Yes, well, the pandemic throws a wrench into everything. You know, the data and understanding and scholarly studies we've done all predate the pandemic. And so the fact that actually going to your polls to vote could endanger your health and that of you, those around you, and is also perhaps causing a further consolidation of polling places. There may be a shortage of polling workers that compels even fewer polling stations because many polling volunteers are older and therefore in high-risk groups. So yes, it compounds things a great deal. And to the extent that there are segments of non-voters that don't vote because they feel like it's futile or that it doesn't matter, the fact that we're now worried about the security and effectiveness of mail-in voting because of the delays in the Postal Service and the president's remarks on it is probably only increasing the sort of cynicism. So yeah, there's a lot of factors at play that complicate 2020 even more than prior elections that have been studied.
We're talking to Colin Woodard, contributing editor for Politico magazine, and Professor Bernard Fraga, author of The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. We're also talking to you. We heard from one of our text club members who says, I've voted consistently since I was 18, and I have great trouble understanding why people don't vote. I'm looking forward to hearing the reasons people offer. I volunteer with voter organizations, and maybe understanding why people don't vote will help me reach out. Well, another listener tweets, I've been a registered Republican for 31 years. I haven't voted since 2004, but I will be voting this year. Amanda writes on Facebook, I've never voted in my life because I never thought my voice mattered. When it comes to presidential elections, what the Electoral College wants, the Electoral College gets. I am voting for the first time in 2020. I feel this election is the most important one of my life. Colin, talk a bit more about the different kinds of non-voters and the subgroups that exist within this larger group.
Yes, that was one of the most intriguing things with this Knight study, which it's in-depth because of the scale of it. They interviewed more than 13,000 people across the country, and they had in-depth focus group conversations with thousands of them to understand, you know, their media diets and social networks and preferences and the values behind their decisions. So it's a very comprehensive survey. And it echoed things that others had started putting together that show that it's a bit of a fool's errand to look at non-voters as one group and try to talk about why don't they vote. They fall, just like the electorate, into perceivable clusters who have very different reasons for not voting. And if they voted, as groups, have very different political and partisan leanings. So the lessons of that, you know, there are essentially, they identified two large camps that you might think about. One camp are what Ibram Kendi has called the other swing voters. In other words, not those who are trying to decide, am I going to vote for the Democrats or Republicans this time, but am I going to vote for the only party that I would consider voting for, or am I going to sit out this election because I don't like what they have on offer, or am not, you know, convinced by the candidate. And so there's this group of passive liberals, you might call them, who would almost always vote for the Democratic candidate, but their choice is, you know, do they believe that the Democratic candidate this time is worth turning out for? And oftentimes, because this group tends to be younger, lower income, more likely to be African American, more likely to be urban, often the bar to voting through various complications, voter suppression and difficulty with registrations and long lines at polling places, often the cost of voting can be fairly high, which only increases the bar. There's also a camp that's a bit smaller of passive conservatives who would only only consider voting for the Republican Party, but if they're, you know, not not enamored with the choices that are placed before them, they also would sit it out. Mm. And that put together those two groups, the sort of the passive liberal camp is sort of like 42% of the non-voters that the Knight survey looked at, and the passive conservative one's sort of 17%, so it's smaller. But that leaves another big chunk of the electorate, like 42% of non-voters don't fall into those groups, and that's an entirely different category.
Well, I want to
these are the people who are really disillusioned with and alienated from politics at a more profound level.
I want to talk more about that a little later. But Professor Fraga, you argue that institutional hurdles, like what Colin just described, that make the process of voting difficult may not actually be the biggest factor in determining minority voter turnout. Why?
Yeah, you know, that's right. I think that when we have discussions about voter suppression, for example, it's very important to note that especially given the low rate of voter turnout that we see in the United States, you know, it's very questionable to make it harder for anybody to vote. However, when we think about the reasons people give for not voting, they don't often mention the kinds of voter suppression tactics that we see implemented on kind of a large scale, voter identification laws, for example. You know, most Americans have identification that they need in order to vote. But I think what we have to talk about is the campaigns. Are they doing their job to convince voters why their votes matter?
We're talking to Bernard Fraga, author of The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America, and Colin Woodard, contributing editor for Politico magazine. We're discussing the reasons many Americans don't vote. And we're talking to you. Marty tweets, I come from a family where voting isn't a right, it's your duty. We often voted as a family, and we were never asked to reveal our vote. We'll hear more from you in a moment. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. I'm Jen White. We're discussing the reasons why many eligible Americans don't vote with Colin Woodard, contributing editor at Politico magazine, and Professor Bernard Fraga, author of The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. We're also talking to you. If you've skipped voting in an election or don't believe in voting altogether, we want to know why. You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. I want to check in with someone who's lost faith in the voting process. George is a 1A listener from Seattle, Washington, where he listens to the show on KUOW. George, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So where do you stand on voting and why?
I vote if it's a direct initiative or a referendum or a local nonpartisan race, but as far as federal elections, I have really given up faith that my vote really counts for anything. I live in a state that already has gone to Joe Biden. We haven't even had a single vote cast yet. I have a friend who lives in Kentucky. That state has already gone for Donald Trump without a single vote being cast yet. And to me, it just makes it seem pointless. There's really no discussion. It really comes down to a handful of swing states. They're going to determine the election, and we're not being addressed or talked to about anything or involved in any way. So my vote really doesn't seem to matter.
What do you say to people who say, look, you can't count on your state always voting in a certain way? I'm thinking back to prior to 2016, Michigan was considered a blue state, but it ended up going for Trump by a very, 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 very slim margin.
Yes, that's true in a handful of swing states, and the campaigns know that, and that's why six states are getting virtually all of the attention and all of the campaign dollars are going to those states, and that's the way it's set up. The two parties have been allowed to gerrymander things in terms of local and legislative elections to the point where 72%, I believe, is the last time I read, have already been decided again before a single vote is cast. I live in a district where oftentimes the person running for federal office is unopposed because there is no other voice.
Is there something that could shift in the way we run elections, in the way our political system works that could change your mind?
I think that it would have to be a huge systemic shift. I look at places where there's multiple party systems, where there's a parliamentary system where more voices are heard. When I talk to my friend in Kentucky about, well, why do you folks always vote for the for Mitch McConnell, for example, he says, actually, if you look at the statistics, the majority of people, their vote is none of the above. But there is no none of the above on the ballot, so they don't have that choice. So they just don't vote. But the majority of people don't vote. And there's this the idea that people not voting is out of lethargy or out of some feeling that it's, you know, that it's a bother, it's a hassle. And really, I think a lot of people don't who don't vote are like me. They don't vote in those elections because they don't see it making any difference. And their real vote is, we don't want any of this, or we don't want these people. But that's not an option. So the only option is not to vote.
So how do you experience presidential election season when you don't plan on casting a vote in 2020?
Oh, it's inescapable. It's a constant discussion in the media. It's a constant discussion everywhere, except amongst the people that I know, because, again, it's a foregone conclusion. I don't hear a lot of discussion. And I talked to, again, I keep using my friend in Kentucky as an example. I said, well, what's the conversation there? And he said, no one talks about it. I hear all this stuff about how, oh, there's this groundswell of support for Trump and there's all this enthusiasm, but he says he doesn't see it or hear it. It's just really this feeling that it's already been taken care of. It's already known how it's going to turn out. And there's plenty of publicity to that end in order to make people not want to vote.
That's George. He's a 1A listener from Seattle, Washington, where he listens on KUOW. George, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And still with us are Colin Woodard, contributing editor at Politico magazine, and Bernard Fraga, author of The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. Bernard, you've talked about the importance of voters feeling like their vote is valued by candidates, and I think we heard some of that reflected in what George had to say. Why is that important?
I think that, you know, George's comments were very informative. I live right now in the state of Georgia, a swing state, although it's gone Republican, you know, recently. The idea that the Democrats might pick it up this year is a very attractive possibility for the party. And I think that for people who don't live in swing states, you know, the national discussions, individuals might care about who wins and who loses, but they understand that correctly. It's just the fact that their votes are not going to have a dramatic impact on the outcome of the election. The problem is that's usually true, but as you mentioned on the call, in a state like Michigan, which is part of the blue wall before 2016, it did make a difference who voted. And just a small change in who voted, a shift in Detroit in terms of how many African Americans turned out to vote, would have meant that that state would have flipped over and gone for Clinton. So I think that it's incumbent on not necessarily the voters themselves, but the campaigns to reinforce and emphasize how important every single vote is, even in a state where it seems like the outcome is a foregone conclusion.
Well, we're hearing from many of you. One of you texted, my boyfriend gave up voting years ago because of the Electoral College. He believes his vote doesn't count, especially when it's not in a swing state. And Colin, you know, this issue of swing states, we heard it from Professor Fraga there. We also heard it from George. How much is this issue of the Electoral College playing into people feeling disengaged in this process?
I think there's a lot of indication that it adds to it, because what you hear echoed across many of these different clusters of non-voters is the feeling that, you know, their vote really doesn't matter, or the person they're going to vote for isn't going to change things, or the system's corrupted. And all of those things are only enhanced by, you know, federalism and gerrymandering and all of those other elements that make, you know, people in some constituencies and districts and states, their votes not mattering that much because their state's not competitive and it's a foregone conclusion, or the districts are drawn in such a way where it isn't. And their votes may in fact matter as you go down the ballot to other races, and that the people who win those races or not will have an enormous effect on lives. But what really drives people's voting is usually the top of the ticket. And that's the place, unfortunately, where all of these things conspire to indeed make a lot of people's votes not matter as much at the top of the ticket races.
Well, we heard from Jeremiah, who says, we never hear anything about a third party candidate, and they're never taken seriously or given an opportunity. It's all Trump or Biden, both of whom are completely out of touch with the majority of Americans. And we got several voicemails from listeners who aren't happy with the major party candidates or the two-party system in general.
My name is Lynn. I did not vote in the last presidential election. I'd like to vote in this one. I suppose I'll be forced to do that by my own conscience. I do not see the difference between Democrats and Republicans anymore.
My name is Sophie. I'm calling from Pittsburgh, and I think a big reason that people don't vote is because we don't have candidates that represent us. The majority of at least Democrats favor Medicare for all. Joe Biden doesn't, still, in the middle of a pandemic. We don't have anybody promising to cancel debt, legalize marijuana. These are the things that we would vote for, we would turn out for, but they're not giving them to us.
This is Kelly calling from Wisconsin. I have a son who has a PhD and is in his 30s, and he has never, ever voted. And it's because he's so against the two-party system. He said it's not fair that we have to choose between these two candidates.
Lynn, Sophie, Kelly, thanks for leaving us those voicemails. Colin, I'm hearing two things there. One is dissatisfaction with the choices, and then another is with the system, the two-party system itself. Let's focus in on that two-party system argument first and how that plays into this issue of people feeling disengaged with the political process.
Yeah, well, I think it absolutely adds to it. I mean, some of the advantages of a parliamentary system where you'd be able to snap your fingers and have such is that you get parties that have a broad spectrum of political beliefs, and a voter is more likely to find a match for their beliefs. Given a binary choice in an incredibly complicated country with, you know, all sorts of 21st century issues which are nuanced, and people have, you know, a wide variety of actual beliefs and values to bring to bear, but they're presented with a binary choice, you know, this or that. And if you don't feel like you like either of those choices, you don't have a third option. So, but unfortunately, you know, the Constitution is what it is, and it's very difficult to change it. So while that is absolutely adding to the dissatisfaction and to the increase in non-voters, it's not something in and of itself that's very easy to change. Whereas the other factor that they were bringing up, the whether they're enthusiastic about a particular party's candidate, is something that the parties, as a tactical and strategic decisions, have a little more control over and can affect turnout and results quite a bit.
Well, and in regards to not being enamored of either candidate, we do see people saying, I'm not going to vote. Is that an effective expression of protest?
It may not be an effective expression, but a lot of people do it. I mean, the scholarly data and this Knight Foundation survey are basically showing that a lot of people, you know, something like 58% of these non-voters are in these other swing groups where they're judging their default party's candidate as to whether or not they think they're up to snuff and are enthusiastic about them. And some of your callers were suggesting that they weren't about either candidate or their default party candidate. But sometimes there's a candidate that does inspire a significant number of these passive sort of other swing voters who usually don't vote. Barack Obama turned out a lot of the sort of passive liberal voters in 2008, and Donald Trump clearly brought some in key swing states into play, people who didn't usually vote from a passive conservative camp that was, you know, probably made a difference in his margin. Even more so because if you look at the those who didn't vote, the difference between Hillary Clinton's turnout in key districts and Barack Obama's, there's clearly a lot of people who turned out for Barack Obama in 2008 and even in 2012 who weren't as enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton and stayed at home from these passive camps, which, you know, if you look at the math, is easily enough to have swung Michigan and Wisconsin into Donald Trump's column. So these things matter quite a bit, and those are you know, candidates and issues, and are you speaking to issues that inspire enough people in your coalition, you know, that you have credibility that you'll really do these things and that you're promising to do things that people really want. That's the portion that we have easier control over as a society than the incredibly laborious process of trying to actually change our Constitution.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're talking to Colin Woodard, contributing editor at Politico Magazine, and Professor Bernard Fraga, author of The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. We're also talking to you. Rick tweets, I think it has to be a popular vote. It baffles me how the person the most people want to win doesn't. Karen tweets, the key is lowering the voting age to 16. They are civically and functionally adults, taxed without representation. And Jasmine says, I voted in every election since I turned 18, but I understand the frustration of non-voters. We have a polarized system that doesn't allow for many options. I think changing to ranked choice voting would be a good move. Colin, how have voter turnout rates in America looked over time? Have they always been relatively low?
Well, there are times in our deep past where they were very high as a percentage of the eligible electorate, but those were times when the real issue was who was allowed to vote, right? Women couldn't vote. African Americans and many non-white people and Native Americans weren't allowed to vote. Young people, you know, under the age of 21 couldn't vote in many places. In many states, you know, you couldn't cast a popular vote for president. The legislature decided those things and so on. So our story over time, one story is more people being allowed to vote. And as the franchise increased, you didn't have the same 80 and 85% turnout that you had in the days when the franchise was very, very restricted. What's happened most recently, though, in the world since 1971, when the last, you know, that young people were added to those who could vote, 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds, the trend has been a worrying decline that proceeded on into the late 90s from, you know, 60-something percent turnout in big elections down, you know, getting down to about 50. And then a slow, over the 2000s and more recently, a slow, gentle uptick to a certain extent. And part of that may be due to the differences in the way that parties are interacting with voters, with a lot more hands-on approach of actually canvassing and going door to door, which appears to be something that matters. People want to be reached out to and, you know, asked to vote, and those social connections matter a lot, and whether somebody's going to vote in a given election, but even more important, whether or not they are voters or non-voters to begin with has to do with the sort of social context of who around them is voting and how committed people are in their lives to that.
Well, Bernard, part of your work looks at voter turnout among different racial groups dating all the way back to the 1800s. Explain a little bit about those patterns and what they can tell us about what's happening today.
Sure. So, you know, as Colin mentioned, we saw higher rates of voter turnout in, you know, the 1800s. The franchise was effectively expanded to white men, all white men in the United States in, you know, the 1820s, 1830s. And then after that, we saw a rapid increase in rates of voter turnout, reaching about 80%. Even during Reconstruction, when you're talking about the freedmen, you know, formerly enslaved African-American men being given the right to vote, voter turnout was very, very high for those recently freed slaves as well, despite, you know, obviously socioeconomic hardship and rampant voter suppression and violence committed against Black men who were trying to vote. And I think the lesson that we learned from that is that it's really about the campaigns and mobilization activities that the parties do. After Reconstruction, very contested elections, that's where you saw tremendous effort being made by the parties to convince voters, even the freed slaves, that their votes actually mattered. And I think that's what's absent today. Today we see very low rates of voter turnout for Latinos and for Asian Americans, in part because the parties feel like those votes just don't matter as much as for the more traditional white swing voters.
That's Bernard Fraga, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University and author of The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. And Colin Woodard, contributing editor for Politico Magazine and author of Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Thanks to you both. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in just a moment. We're talking about why so many Americans are choosing not to vote with Colin Woodard, contributing editor for Politico magazine and author of Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. And I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Kat Calvin is the founder and executive director of Spread the Vote, a nonprofit organization that's working to increase voter turnout. Kat, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So one of the main things your organization is trying to do is close the gap between registered voters and voter turnout. How big of a gap are we talking about?
Well, about 83% of eligible voters in the country are registered, but we have an average turnout of, 55%, 50%, maybe a little higher depending on the election. So there is a huge gap of tens of millions of voters who are registered. They've taken that first step, but who have a hard time taking the many steps that it takes to actually get a ballot in.
So we hear a lot about voter registration drives, but why is that not enough?
You know, voter reg drives are great. They're a first step. In every state except North Dakota, you have to be registered to vote. But the fact is there are a lot of things that you have to do in between that. So, for instance, one of the main things that Spread the Vote does is that we help people get IDs, primarily in voter ID states. There are over 21 million eligible voters who don't have photo ID, but 36 states where it's required. So that means that you can look at states like Wisconsin, where there are over 300,000 registered voters who don't actually have the ID they need to vote, or 200,000 in Virginia, et cetera. And so, that's just one big way that voter registration isn't actually looking at what are all the other challenges. There's also transportation challenges. There's childcare. We have a massive problem with discrimination against people with disabilities at the polls, and then a huge, huge voter education gap. And so there are just a lot of things that we need to address between registration and turnout to make sure we're actually helping people vote.
Explain a little bit more about the voter education gap that you see.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I was listening to some of the questions that people had coming in. Also, I want to send bonus points to the tweeter who said that we should be doing ranked choice voting, because she's absolutely right. But, the fact is that we don't do a lot of civics education in schools anymore, and then we really don't do it after school. And so a lot of people just don't really understand the voting process, who they're voting for, what we're voting for. We do a ton of voter education at Spread the Vote. 77% of our clients have never voted before. And in midterms, we had people in age ranging from 18 to 79 voting for the first time. Mm-hmm. And when they ask us questions, or when we get sort of thousands of questions that people just email us, because we're an organization with Vote in the name, and it's everything from, I don't know how I'm supposed to use this machine. I don't understand the difference between absentee voting and mail-in voting and what's early voting. I don't know what any of these positions are. Nobody knows what the comptroller is or what the board of supervisors is. We get a lot of first-time voters who we talk to, and they say, I opened my ballot and I thought it was just going to be the president, but there were like 30 pages of things that I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I don't know what a ballot measure is. And so there's just a lot of sort of this basic info. There's also, we get people who say, I just opened my mail-in ballot and there's a bunch of pieces of paper here and I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it, And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done on just helping people understand what the process is and how do you vote and how do you follow all these instructions. And then when you look at, people returning citizens, the rules for returning citizens being able to vote are different everywhere, and there isn't a lot of information out about how people are supposed to know if they're eligible to vote again, how they become eligible. People with disabilities don't always know what all the ADA requirements are and what accessibility requirements there are and what they're allowed to, demand that they have at their polling place. And so there's just a lot of really voting 101 information that people don't get.
Well, we got this tweet from Benjamin who says, I think the problem with voter apathy is that many people view voting purely as a response to an agenda they did not set. It's important to stress to voters that they are just as much responsible for setting the agenda as they are for voting to set that agenda into motion. And I'm curious how much you hear from people about, that issue of, look, I'm voting for something that I don't feel particularly a part of.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, if we had all been listening to Ralph Nader in the 70s, this would be a very different country, because he basically was advocating for an indivisible, right? He kept saying, voting is just one day. We have to be sure that we are keeping these politicians accountable, that we're telling them what we want, that we're making sure that they do it. And, one of the things that we try really hard to do now is remind people that voting is not the whole movement, but it's a big part of it. And that it is a thing we have to do, once a year or twice a year, however many times you vote in your community. But it is just one way of changing this democracy, of setting the agenda. And so we have to still be taking to the streets. We have to still be calling into the police commission meetings or going to city council meetings. You know, we have to be finding and recruiting really amazing members of our community who we think would be great, you know, members of elected office, and then supporting them. It's a lot more than voting, but voting, because we live in a democracy, is a key part. And I think when people understand, I'm not just voting once a year and walking away, and then someone else is making decisions, but that I'm helping to set those decisions and push those decisions. And once a year, voting is my way of grading how I think that those decisions were made, and maybe hiring somebody new and firing someone, et cetera, then it puts the power a lot more into the voters' hands.
Colin Woodard, I want to bring you back into the conversation. We got this message from Simple Man who says, you've totally skimmed over third parties. The Libertarian Party is on the ballot in all 50 states, yet is suppressed by the media. And I have to say, a lot of the feedback we got from listeners in advance of this conversation was focused on frustration with the two-party system and that they feel like they have this binary. But how does the third-party issue fit into this?
Well, the trick for us is, you know, because of our constitutional arrangements, it sort of is a binary choice in that it's a first past the, you know, winner gets all, first past the post decision. You know, if a third party gets a certain minority percentage of the votes, it's not like they get a minority percentage of the seats. So the concern and the angst around it because of those arrangements is that third-party candidates represent a spoiler. They can't possibly win, but they could change the outcome of the election elsewhere. And that's, you know, enormously frustrating, and in and of itself becomes a corrosive effect. Thus the interest in ranked choice voting. I happen to live in Maine, which is a state which has gone ahead with ranked choice voting. There's various challenges, but we're doing our federal elections are done that way now. And that removes the spoiler effect problem. You can vote your heart and conscience if you want to vote for any candidate you want, but it gives you the opportunity at the same time to put down a second ranking for if that person doesn't make the first cut of who your second choice is. And so reforms like that, that allow a higher resolution feedback from voters as to what they really want, I think can only strengthen the, you know, democracy and the credibility of our democracy, and therefore people's interest in participating in it as you know, civic-minded citizens, which is what the whole the democratic experiment is presumes that we will have such.
We got this tweet from Soul Power, and a lot of you are chiming in along the same lines. They say, we need a federal election day holiday. We should have the day off to vote. It's hard to get out and vote on election day because I'm working on Tuesdays. Kat, how much of a barrier is this for people that, you know, I might have to take time off of work. I may not have paid leave. I may be waiting to vote for hours.
Well, so, you know, this is definitely a huge problem. I think there are a lot of ways to solve it. So one of the challenges of making Election Day a federal holiday is that kids are out of school, and so then you have childcare problems, that really low-income workers, hourly workers, are still working, right? Like, McDonald's doesn't close down on national holidays, and so you still have a lot of people who don't have access to the polls because it's a holiday. You also, if you're making Election Day a federal holiday, you have everybody voting on one day, which is exactly the thing we're trying to avoid. So there are a lot of measures that most states actually are taking that are really opening up the franchise. So, for instance, early voting. 47 states have early voting, some for 1 or 2 weeks or even more. We've got some states that have already started voting. And that is incredible because then you have weeks, you have weekends, you can go vote anywhere. And so people can choose the right time. It also significantly reduces lines. If you have polls open for a month, then, you know, there is much less of a chance that you're going to have an 8-hour line on election day. You know, also expanding vote by mail. You know, it's one of the very, very few good things about 2020 and the apocalypse is that we've got states that are saying, oh, people should be able to vote by mail, and are mailing out ballots to everyone, or mailing out applications, or opening up the excuses that you need to vote absentee. And voting by mail, I only vote with my PJs at my house. It comes to my home. I do it here. I mail it back, right? And so there are a lot of different things that we can do to expand the franchise. I think that a national holiday is not necessarily the choice that's going to make it easier for everyone, but there are a lot of things that are being done around the country to help as many people not have to deal with that problem as possible.
We got this tweet from Brett who says, I live in Oklahoma and am often frustrated by party loyalty and straight ticket voting. People often treat voting like sport in that they vote for their side instead of whose platform addresses current issues. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. And we're talking to Kat Calvin, founder and executive director of Spread the Vote. It's a nonprofit working to close the gap between registered voters and voter turnout. And we're also here with Colin Woodard, contributing editor for Politico magazine and author of Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. And we got this voicemail from someone who's disillusioned by the political process.
Hi, my name is Layla. I'm from Fort Myers, Florida. It seems that no matter who we vote for or what issues we vote for, majority of us do not benefit. And therefore, it becomes a sense of purposelessness. And that's how I feel. And I certainly do feel frustrated enough that with COVID going on, I may not even want to vote, both to not get sick and waiting at the polling. And just I feel like my issue wouldn't make any difference anyway.
I mean, Kat, I'm sure this is something you've heard from folks you work with. What's your response to Layla? And Layla, thanks for that message.
Thanks, Layla. And, you know, this is a thing that we're talking to a lot of young people in Florida about particularly. You know, if you look at Florida in 2018, voters on both sides of the aisle overwhelmingly voted to re-enfranchise returning citizens. It was an incredible win. And then almost immediately, the state legislature and the governor did everything they could to block that. And so now we have a decision that was just made the other day that affirmed that returning citizens are going to have to pay fines and fees before they can vote. And that is a big blow, because now we talk to so many young people who say, why bother voting? We voted, we won, and they took it away from us anyways. And my response is, okay, so then fire those people, right? Like, those are the people who then you need to decide, you can't represent me anymore because we made a decision and you did everything you could to subvert that. And so I think the important thing for voters like Layla to know is that if you want those things to change, if you want to be represented, that the answer is not to vote. The answer is to vote and make sure your friends vote and make sure your family votes and make sure your community votes, and then go be in the streets and be in that person's office and, you know, tweet at that person. It's fantastic to tweet at politicians because it's public humiliation, right? And like, and be sure that you're constantly on them, letting them know what you want. And you know what? Yeah. Change is going to be slow. And sometimes those incumbents are going to win a couple times before you can get them out. And it sucks. But that's the system that we live in. And the way to change the system is not to back out of it. It's to double down and jump in.
Well, we got this tweet from someone who says, I think it's important to point out the racist voter suppression tactics that exploded across the nation with the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, specifically targeting Black and brown voters. And Kat, this is something your organization is working on. What are some of the ways voter suppression is showing up, and how are you pushing back against it?
Well, look, I mean, this is the whole reason that I started my nonprofit. You know, my grandmother used to always tell me a story about watching her parents every election day pick up a jar of change that they had been throwing money into all year and counting out how much they needed to pay a poll tax. And that was, that was voter suppression. It was very blatant, but it was something that they were lucky enough to be able to overcome. Now we have things like voter ID laws. We have voter purging. We have all of these different methods of voter suppression that are really difficult to overcome. I mean, the whole reason I had to start an organization to help people get IDs is because it's a very hard and pricey thing to do. And they are absolutely targeted at low-income voters, at voters of color, at very young and elderly voters. It's where we have to jump in and we have to say, all right, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that each person can vote. You know, we just started a 501c4 so that we can try to change these on a policy level too. And it's also, you know, one of the things that I try to tell people is, look, there are, until we solve these suppressive measures, there are going to be people who cannot vote, which is why it's so much more important that if you can vote, you do, because none of us are just voting for ourselves, right? We are all voting for people who can't vote. And it's so critical that we make sure that we're representing them too.
Well, Mary is channeling a lot of the feedback we've had on Facebook. She says, people who choose not to vote or to cast worthless protest votes pee me off. Democracy takes work, it takes investment, it takes a willingness to keep pushing at all levels in order to turn incremental change into major progress. And Colin, ultimately, put this into perspective for us. What does it mean for democracy to have this many people who are eligible to vote, but who choose not to?
Right. Well, if you step back at a big perspective, I mean, what we've been trying to do for several centuries now as a country and many other countries out there is that, you know, to create this new thing, this society where all people can be as meaningfully free as possible and self-governing, as liberal democratic experiment. But that whole experiment is, you know, built upon the presumption that you'll have a citizenry whose interested and informed and engaged in civic affairs, and that will be committed to the civic institutions and public goods that, you know, foster individual freedom, especially over generations. You know, that somebody's circumstance of their birth will not completely determine whether they'll be able to be meaningfully free or not. But those habits of the heart, you know, that Alexis de Tocqueville, the much quoted 19th century French aristocrat who visited the country, you know, said that those things, those habits and customs of the people were going to be the most important factor in whether or not this American experiment he was looking at would succeed. And so when you have a large number of people who are disillusioned, believe that this isn't working and are choosing not to be civically engaged, that's an important symptom to be very aware of and very concerned about.
That's Colin Woodard, contributing editor for Politico magazine and author of Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Also with us, Kat Calvin, founder and executive director of Spread the Vote. Thanks to you both. Well, we're on Instagram. You can follow us at the1ashow.org, or just the1ashow because it's Instagram. Today's producer was Haley Blassingame. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.